So I told you a little bit about this last week. My wife, Susan, and I spent 12 days in Europe. And we were on a cruise, and we did this in kind of a weird way in that we saw one different city every day. So we were in Barcelona, and then we went to Palma, which is an island off of Spain, and then we went to France and did a city, and then we went to Italy and did three cities, but in one place we did three different cities on one day. And then we came back and did Valencia, and it was a whirlwind of a trip. It was a fantastic trip, things that people say, trip of a lifetime, you know, mainly because your kids weren't there and it's just a really good experience to be able to hang out. I'm just kidding. We really love our kids. But it was a good time for us to be together. But one of the questions that so many people, including some of you, have asked me is, what was your favorite place? Where did you like to go? And that's a really hard question when you're on the Mediterranean going to see all these beautiful places. So when I don't answer that question well, when I name all nine of those places we went, people then say, what was the biggest surprise for you? And that is an easy question for me. The biggest surprise for me was that every European city that we went to wanted to show me their cathedrals. That was the biggest thing that people wanted to show. They'd be like, come and look at this beautiful cathedral, and look at this beautiful cathedral. And I will say, most of the people in our group were really, really excited to see all of these cathedrals. They were super excited. Now, why does that surprise me? I had just read an article right before I went on the trip of how Christianity is dead in Europe. Yet every guide that took us somewhere wanted to show me their cathedral. Come and see this big, beautiful place. Now, I will tell you, this feeling that I had about the cathedrals and being less than excited when I saw them was not nearly as much of a problem for me as it was for my wife's family that we went on this trip with. The very first night that we went and we saw these cathedrals, we get back and we have dinner together and we're all sitting around the table and they all are going, I know what's happening in their head. We know how to connect with the pastor. We'll talk about the cathedrals. So they said, Tim, her aunt looked at me and said, Tim, what did you think of that cathedral today? And I was like, it was all right. The conversation died. It was like over. Their whole connection with me for dinner was done. What else do we say to him? How was biking? Right? I mean, nothing else did they have as a connection. And I felt like I disappointed them. So I started to say, well, the window was nice and this was nice. And they were like, they weren't buying any of it. I mean, none of it was really true. And I started to catch myself. And Susan asked me that first night. She said, what is it about these cathedrals for you? Why are they not? And I said, honey, you know what I'm looking for? I'm looking for the story of what's going on inside and outside of them. I want to hear the story of the first people that walked in, or maybe of what's going on today. And the only thing that the people could tell us was who built it and who designed it and whose name was it in honor of. And if I would ask, hey, do they still have services here today? Most of the tour guides would go, well, I don't know. I don't have a clue what's going on. So this seemingly beautiful building that I can bet you at one point was alive and was connecting to its community seemed to be a remnant of what was once there. They could describe how many people came to visit each year and how many millions of dollars each cathedral would make on people visiting, but not one of the guides could tell me one thing that was actually coming out of the cathedral right now. Not one. And I was disheartened that there are these big, beautiful buildings that are set apart for sacred activity when nothing was coming out of them. I started a new sermon series last week we're calling Strong Living. And the goal of this is to take the gifts and the talents that we have and to use them to engage and encourage and support other people, to take this message out into the world, but also to use them in a way that brings us life and us energy, because I believe we're wired a certain way, and if we use our gifts, it brings us more life. What hit me was we got to the end of the sermon last week, and I said, all right, go figure out your gifts. Good luck. Hope it goes well. And I didn't say why it's important to use them for us individually, other than it brings us life. But I also didn't say that a lot of the importance comes in how we use them, how we offer our gifts, what we do with them, how we take them out into the world. So I want to say something important to you this morning. I believe each and every person in this room has gifts and talents. I believe each and every person in this room is valuable. I think one of the challenges in our culture today is that not enough people tell people they're valuable. Not enough people say that you have worth. Michelle Mullaney was at our Poor Theology on Tuesday night, and if you got to hear it, I hope that you found it as fantastic as I did. It was absolutely amazing. And she came and she talked about how we can actually rewire the brain to think that we have value. And one of the ways that we can do that is simply by looking in the mirror and saying, you have value. To look at ourselves. And we can actually change what's going on in here, the way that our brain thinks, the way that we process, by telling ourselves, you matter, you have worth, you bring gifts, you have strengths. And to do that every single day. Is that not amazing? That actually works? That you can actually change what your amygdala, I know that's a big fancy word, what your amygdala thinks and how it processes and how it perceives other people and situations. One of the challenges that's happening, or that happened in Europe, and I think that's starting to happen in America, is that the church is not doing a good job of telling people they have value and they have gifts and they have strengths and they should go out and take them out into the world. When I sit in circles with pastors, and when I sit in circles with other church workers, they get mad at the people for that. People aren't coming to the church as much anymore. They're spiritual, but not religious. And that's a term to say people believe in God, but they don't believe that community matters around that. They don't believe in organized religion. And my pastor friends get really angry about that. And I say, is that people's fault or is that the church's fault? Is it the church's fault that we're not showing people that there is value in coming together and being encouraged by other people and told that you matter and that you have strengths and that you have gifts? Because I actually think it's one of the church's greatest jobs. I actually can understand why this is happening. When Michelle was talking on Tuesday night at Poor Theology, I thought of this video clip, and I want to show you. It's a very, very short clip. But it's from the movie The Help. And I don't know if you've seen this clip, but I think it's one of the most powerful clips in any movie that I've seen. So I want you to watch it. I think it's just like 30 seconds.
You is kind. You is smart. You is important. You is smart. You is kind. You is important. Oh, that's so good.
Now, I love that scene. I love that scene because Abilene has May there on her lap and she's telling May that, but do you notice that May's telling it right back to her? And I love if you watch them looking into each other's eyes. As soon as Michelle said, if you look into someone's eyes, if you look into your own eyes, you can rewire yourself. What if every single day somebody got up and told you, you is smart, you is kind, you is important? When the rest of the world often seems to be beating that down and stripping that out of people, I think it's beautiful when we do that for one another. I think it is beautiful when the church looks at each other and says, hey, church, you matter. Hey, church, you have value. Hey, church, you're important. And not you matter more than everybody else. You just matter. So when we talk about gifts and we talk about strengths, we need to talk about how we offer those gifts and strengths, because if we offer them in a way that puts others down, or if we offer them in a way that says, I'm grumpy about the fact that I have to use them, then it doesn't build anybody up. It doesn't encourage anybody. So I want to look this morning at 1 Peter chapter 4, right before this passage that we're going to look at this morning. Peter's talking to the Jews who were the insiders and the Gentiles who were the outsiders of the church. And essentially, he's convincing them that they have gifts. You have a strength. You have something to bring. And then we get to this part of the passage where he's telling them, all right, you've got potential. You're not living into it. But here's how to use it and to offer it in a way that gives you more life. Let's look at this starting at verse 8. He says, above all, maintain constant love for one another. For love covers a multitude of sins. You've probably heard that phrase before. Did you know it actually came out of the Bible? For love covers a multitude of sins. Be hospitable to one another without complaining. Like good stewards of the manifold grace of God, serve one another with whatever gift each of you has received. Whoever speaks must do so as one speaking the very words of God. Whoever serves must do so with the strength that God supplies, so that God may be glorified in all things through Jesus Christ. To him belong the glory and the power forever and ever. Amen. Peter looks at this group of people and says, above all, love one another. Use your gifts in a way that make other people feel loved, but use your gifts in a way that makes you feel loved as well. Don't use your gifts to put others down. Be hospitable. What does that mean? Open yourself up to people. Engage people. Let people know that they matter. That idea of hospitality is this idea of opening up, engaging one another, encouraging one another. And don't complain. He kind of just throws that in there. Do you notice? And do it without complaining. Because what Peter knew when he was writing this is the same thing that we all know now, but we don't actually believe. And that's that complaining sucks the life out of us more than it gives us life. What Peter knew was when we complained, it didn't build us up. It didn't encourage us. Complaining just sucked all the energy right out of us. I think sometimes we think it gives us life. Let me just vent a little bit. You know, venting is about getting the air out. It's not about bringing it in. He says, do it all without complaining. And then he says something interesting. And I hadn't caught this before. He says, be good stewards of the grace of God. Do you know what a steward is? A steward is someone who responsibly holds on to something and cares for it that they've been given. To be a good steward of something is to take care of it and use it wisely. Use it for good. And Peter says, you are a steward of God's grace. Look at somebody beside you and say, you are a steward of God's grace. All right, now say it louder to someone else. You are a steward of God's grace. God has given you grace, and it's not just for you to put inside of you and say, I'm the only person that gets it. You are a steward of God's grace. You are to use it responsibly. Take it out into the world. Multiply it. Share it. Help others experience it. I wonder how differently our lives might look if we use our gifts in a way that reveals that we are stewards of God's grace. How differently might our lives look, and how differently might we affect others? In September of 1939, German troops invaded Bielsko in Poland. And there was a 15-year-old girl at the time. Her name was Gerda, and her family survived up until 1942, at which point her mother was stripped from her, and her mother was taken and killed. They found Gerda later, and she was 68 pounds in this concentration camp where she was taken. 68 pounds and frail. And the interesting part of her story is the guy who ended up finding her, the soldier, and saved her, she later ended up marrying him. And they had a life together, and he brought her this grace. But in my opinion, that's still not the coolest part of Gerda's story. Gerda had this friend in the camp named Ilse. And Ilse, one day, was out, and she was walking around the camp, and she found one raspberry on the ground. And she picked up that one raspberry. Fruit was not something that they would get in the camp. And she picked up that one raspberry, and she stuck it in her pocket. And she found a leaf, and later that evening, when her and Gerda were together quietly, she took the one raspberry, and she put it on a leaf, and she gave it to her friend. The one raspberry that she found, she took, and she graciously gave to her friend. Now, this story comes because it's inscribed at a Holocaust memorial up in Boston. There are these six towers. Think about like these six candles here and these six towers. And on each of the towers, it tells of the horrific things that happened to Jews. But on one of them, it's specifically dedicated to hope. And this story of the raspberry is inscribed on one of the towers as a story of hope in the midst of a terrible tragedy, in the midst of a terrible storm. The gift that Ilse brought Gerda that day was a gift to say, you are loved and you are valued. I don't actually think the gift is so much the raspberry, because it was one raspberry. But the gift was for Elsie to say to her, I found this today, and the moment I found it, I thought of you. The moment I found it, I thought my friend Gerda would really love this. And to someone who had been in a concentration camp, I wonder how her self-esteem and her self-worth and her self-value was beaten down day after day after day. And can you imagine the light that came out of one little girl bringing her a raspberry? Using the gift that she found to bless her. Friends, Peter says, offer your gifts with joy. Once you identify them, use them. Use them in a way that brings life to others, because when we do it that way, we see that our gifts bring joy not only to others, but they bring us life and joy as well.